Thanks, Jeff. Okay. The questions I would like to address in the next 30 minutes are the following. What are the likely compositions of small planets? So by small planets, I mean planets between 1 and 2.5 times the radius of the Earth. Two, is there a maximum mass for an analog of a terrestrial planet but around another star? Is there a maximum size to terrestrial planets? And three, what are the prospects for improving our knowledge in the next 3 years? So if you're wondering whether to believe these astronomers are worth investing some of your time in, it might be helpful to know about the near-term future. The Kepler mission, of course, has revolutionized our understanding of the population of planets, small planets, orbiting other stars. Here I'm showing the distribution, the number of planets per star, as inferred from the Kepler mission. Okay? So on the y-axis, I'm showing the number of planets per star, and on the x-axis, I'm showing the radius of the signal. So the radius is something we can measure pretty much directly from the Kepler data. The point is, and presumably this was one of the major drivers for organizing this meeting, is that we've learned that the most common kind of planet in the galaxy, at least out to an orbital period of 85 days, is a planet that is not represented in the solar system. Okay? So we can see that there's this large population of planets with radii above that of the Earth but below that of Neptune and Uranus. And we'd like to understand what they're made of and ultimately how they came to be. So my entire talk will focus on this diagram, so let's get comfortable with it. These are predicted relationships between the radius and the mass of a planet given a certain composition. So here I'm showing the planet radius in Earth units, and here I'm showing the planet mass in Earth units. And then, of course, given a model for the planetary composition, if we believe the planet is differentiated and we believe we understand the equation of state of the various shells, the various materials, we can then predict how the radius should vary with mass. And so, for example, a pure iron body would have this curve, a pure magnesium silicate body would have this curve, and then water, and then above that would be gaseous bodies. Okay. So I'm an observer, and so what I'm going to do is I'm going to curate the data. My goal here is to think carefully about each point we put on this plot and only put very high-quality measurements on this plot so that we are not led astray. So to get on this plot, I have to find a measurement, make a measurement, where the radius of the planet is below 2.7 Earth radii. And we have to have determined the mass to better than 20%. And we have to really believe that the determination is good to 20%, taking into account all sources of uncertainty, not just the statistical errors, but the errors perhaps due to the size and mass of the star. So before I dive in, it's worth noting this gray region. So this gray region is predicted to not be populated. And there was a series of models that were run by Robert Marcus, who was a graduate student at Harvard at the time that he did these calculations. And what Robert Marcus and collaborators were doing was simply considering the effect of impacts. So of course, iron and magnesium silicates have roughly the same condensation temperature, and they're assumed to be well mixed in the inner parts of these exosolar systems. So you should be able to form spheres that have roughly the same amount of iron and rock. They would differentiate, and the only way to get boost the density of a body above that nominal composition at formation would be to strike it and remove the mantle. Okay, so to remove the lower density stuff, leaving behind a higher density body. What Robert did was consider single large energetic impacts, and basically was arguing that you wouldn't expect to find a lot of things down here. Okay. So what I want to do is now very carefully put data on this plot, and I think an interesting pattern emerges when I do that. So how do we actually measure the mass and radius of a planet? Okay. So the radius, of course, we infer from the dimming of the starlight as the planet passes in front of the star. So here's a very important system. This is Kepler-36. So this was some anonymous star until Kepler found little blips in the light curve. It's one of the most interesting discoveries from Kepler. what Kepler found, so this is the light curve as a function of time, and you see these little fallouts, these little dimmings that aren't even resolved at the scale. That's the passage of a planet in front of the star. Okay, and here the planet goes every single time in front of its star, so that's its orbital period. And then if I fold the data, I get this light curve. Okay, and then this tells me the size of the planet relative to the star, and then based on an informed estimate of the actual size of the star, I can get the size of the planet in physical units. You with me? Good. There's another signal in these data which you cannot see at this scale, but we can find it, and when we phase fold it, there it is. So this is a much smaller planet. What's special about this system is that the transits of the planets do not occur at equally spaced intervals. Sometimes the eclipse of the planet in front of the star occurs a little early, and sometimes it occurs a little late. And that's because it's a three-body system, and what we're observing is the perturbations of the planet passing in front of the star due to the effect of the other planet. That the good news is that that allows us to infer the masses of these planets directly. So without any additional observations, just from the photometry alone, provided it's of high quality and these signals, as they are in this case, are very large, then we can actually directly estimate the masses and the radii of the planets. Okay? In this case, this was a particularly exciting system because the two periods were very similar. So one orbital period was 14 days and one was 16 days. And yet right away you can see that these are going to be very different planets. This planet is blocking much more light, therefore is much bigger than this planet. Another key point, and this will play a role in the talk for every single system, is astroseismology, which we heard about. Okay? So with very, very high quality data, we can actually see oscillations. These are observed, of course, have been known for many decades in the sun. But basically, these are sound waves, these are standing waves, that allow us to probe the density throughout the bulk of the star. That, in turn, gives us a very precise constraint on the mass and the radius of the star, and also the age. So generally, if astronomers are observing a sun-like star, and we don't have this information, we really can't tell you the age. It's very difficult for us to tell you whether the star is 1 billion years old or 6 billion years old. Of course, planets change a lot over that time scale. So when we think about the planet, of course, that's a real unfortunate missing piece of information. That isn't true with astroseismology. With astroseismology, stars become more centrally concentrated. As they age, they're converting hydrogen to helium. Okay, and that change in the density profile is exquisitely well probed by astroseismology. So astroseismology, which comes also for free, well, by design, but from the same data from Kepler, is also very important in terms of giving us the age, mass, and radius of the star. Okay, so this is the Kepler 36 system, and it yielded a very, very precise mass and radius for the two planets, and let me put them on the plot. Okay, so there's Kepler 36b. Kepler, that's the small guy. Kepler 36c is so big it doesn't even make it on the plot. So it's really not, we're not going to worry about it for the rest of the talk. But Kepler 36b is right there, very intriguing. Okay, importantly, Kepler 36b is the only planet from TTVs that is on this plot. Okay, so I love TTVs and they've told us so much about architectures, so much about masses for which we could never get them. But the point is, unless you go and make follow-up observations of the Kepler systems, really this is the only one that's small and has a really precise mass. Okay? All right. TESS and K2, so other ongoing and future missions, are unlikely to yield a lot of TTV-determined masses because the baseline is short. So this situation is not going to change appreciably. Then we might ask, well, what about contributions outside of Kepler? So there was another space photometry mission. We don't hear much about it now, but it's the Corot mission. And Corot found one particularly exciting planet, which was small, and at the time was the smallest transiting planet known. So Corot was a space-based photometer like Kepler, was a smaller aperture. The difficulty with this Corot 7 system was that when we went to get follow-up observations with ground-based spectrometers to actually get the mass of the planet, we were confounded by the fact that the star was very noisy. So all quiet stars are the same, but all noisy stars are noisy in their own way. And you can see here, this is the plot of the brightness of the star Okay, you can see the brightness of the star wandering up and down, wandering up and down. That's due to spots on the star, and the star is rotating. That's bad, right? The magic of Doppler spectroscopy to get the masses of planets is that the star, the acceleration of the star, is telling us the mass of the planet. But of course, keep in mind the star is rotating, so you have this enormous velocity field, which is averaging to zero. And then you're just seeing the actual Doppler motion of the star. But what happens here is if there's spots on, for example, the approaching limb, then all of a sudden the star gets a net redshift. Okay, so this can completely confound any attempts to go and get the mass of the planet. Nonetheless, this system has been revisited many times, and I think there's a really compelling analysis by Raphael Haywood. Raphael is a graduate student at the University of St. Andrews. And what she did is they gathered simultaneous ground-based radial velocity measurements. So they were using their spectrometers on the ground to get precise Doppler measurements. At the time that Corot went back and got better photometry, the Corot photometry told us what the star was doing during the actual observations, and so Raphael was able to correct the Corot 7 measurement. So let's add Corot 7 to the plot. Okay, so that's where Corot 7 currently fits. The mass and radius precision are not as good as yielded from Kepler 36, but it still meets my cutoff, so it gets to be on the plot. That's it for Corot. So Corot will not give us other points on this plot. Corot did not find other small planets. Okay, so it really falls to Kepler, K2, and ground-based follow-up of Kepler and K2 to really fill in this plot further. So with that in mind, we began a process many years ago to build the HARPS North spectrograph. So basically, HARPS was a very successful, very precise, ultra-stabilized spectrograph in the Southern Hemisphere, which had one flaw, which was that it was in the Southern Hemisphere, where you couldn't see the Kepler field of view. We could never observe the Kepler stars. HARPS North was otherwise largely a copy. It does have some improvements, which I'm happy to tell you about later. And it sits at the Italian National Telescope in the Canary Islands, in the Spanish Canary Islands, in La Palma. It's a partnership between the Geneva Observatory, the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, where I'm based, as well as the Italian National Institute and a number of UK universities. Its features are that it is incredibly stabilized, so without doing any wavelength calibration, the internal stability of the instrument drifts by less than, if you take one spectrum and then take another spectrum, the drift is less than 1 meter a second per 24-hour period. So we do a lot of calibrations throughout the night because we want to do better than that. But out of the box, we're already doing 1 meter per second. Okay. Importantly, we have 80 guaranteed mites per year. So that means that we can, and those are in the top scientific priority is the follow-up of Kepler planets. So it's an enormous resource. We put a lot of effort into figuring out among the thousands of Kepler candidates that have been given to us from the effort of this enormous team, the Kepler team, which ones would be most worthy of our attention. So there are some stars that initially appear great, they're very appealing, but then on closer inspection we expect the stars to be noisy because of pulsations going on in the star, rotation of the star, and so on. And so we did a big effort to use the Kepler photometry to go and look and decide which stars would likely have the smallest jitter, the smallest astrophysical noise, so that then they were the most profitable for us to go and make mass measurements. Okay, so basically I led this selection team. We initially began with all the planet candidates from Kepler that were smaller than 3 Earth radii and had a period less than 50 days. We'd love to get the masses for periods longer than 50 days. The signal is simply too weak. So we currently can't hope to do that with Kepler. We want stars with astroseismology. I've already told you why that's important. Ultimately, we're measuring the mass and the radius of the planet relative to the star. If you want those quantities in physical units, you're actually limited by your knowledge of the star in physical units. And then we did this photometric analysis. And just to give you a flavor for that, for every single Kepler star that met those criteria, which was still more than 1,000, we looked at the photometry. This is a plot of a light curve as a function of time, and many stars are highly variable. If you were to look at higher resolution of these data, you would see a beautiful rotation period. The star has spots. The spots come in and out of view. They're differentially rotating. It's wonderful astrophysics. It's a really bad target for radial velocity measurements, okay, because that's going to completely confound your signal. Similarly, we want to throw at systems where the planet orbital period is at the same period as the stellar rotation, or at some multiple of that. Okay, and there were further cuts. And then we simply did a cost calculation where we said, let's take all the survivors and rank them by telescope time. Our goal is a 15% mass measurement, and these planets are going to be small. They're about 1.5 Earth radii. So this is very demanding. Okay, this is a huge investment of telescope time to go and get each of these systems. Okay, so let me start to show you the systems that we've been observing over the last season, really over the last two seasons. So Kepler-78, of course, you've heard about. This was the planet that's just a little bit bigger than Earth, which Andrew Howard talked about. It's exceptional. It's a dream system for us because it's small, but at a very short orbital period. So the short orbital period means that at a fixed mass, the acceleration of the star is greater. So just from an opportunity standpoint, it's easier to get a precise mass measurement. I would love to do planets at longer periods. We can't do that. So we have to be opportunistic here. Okay. So this is the Kepler-78 system. This is the initial photometry, which Andrew noted is quite variable. So this is the brightness as a function of time. But these are the individual transits that pop out. And here are our data. Okay, so a very, very nice measurement of the acceleration. So this change, again, just to be clear, the change in the velocity of the star, that's the acceleration of the star due to the planet. That tells us the mass of the planet. Okay, so we published that in Nature back-to-back with the paper led by Andrew Howard and his team. Kepler-10. Kepler-10 has long been one of the highlight discoveries from the Kepler mission. The original discovery paper on Kepler-10b was led by Natalie Battaglia, our first speaker. What we decided to do was we really wanted exquisite mass measurements for Kepler-10 because the planet is small, and so in principle it could be a very important contribution to the mass radius diagram. Kepler-10 actually has two transiting planets. Okay, there's one that transits at a very short orbital period of about 0.8 days. Then there was a longer system out at 45 days, this longer planet, which was also comparable in size. There was a preliminary mass measurement for the inner planet, and there was really no mass measurement at all for the outer planet. So we decided to put a lot of effort, and here's our data, phase folded to the two periods, the short period Kepler-10b planet and the longer period Kepler-10c planet. And these are the light, really exquisite light curves from the Kepler photometry. Intriguingly, this is a very old system. So this system also has that astroseismology. We can assert the age is 10.6 plus or minus 1.4 gigayears. So mostly astronomers are left with spectra, and by interpreting the spectrum of a star and comparing it to evolutionary models, if we had to do things that James Webb will allow us to probe the atmospheres of these planets, and we'll be finding